Welcome to the Retail Inside Out podcast from Retail Gazette. In each episode of this podcast, we take a look beyond the headlines to give you a deeper dive into the trends, news, and personalities that are changing the game in our industry. I'm your host, Matt Ridhout. In this episode, we'll be talking all things sustainability, and we're thrilled to be joined by Ruth Andrade, Earth Care Strategy Lead for Lush, this year's Retail Gazette Awards Sustainability Game Changer category winner. Thanks for joining us, Ruth.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a real pleasure to be here, Matt.
Also joining us to share their approach to sustainability is Caroline Sajas, UK Business Director at Lakala. Thank you for joining us, Caroline.
Thank you for having us. Pleasure to be here.
First, let's focus on Lush. Sustainability is obviously at the heart of what Lush does. I think everyone who will be listening will be aware of how important sustainability is to Lush as a retailer. Ruth, could you tell us a little bit about where you have focused your efforts?
Lush, we're about 25 years old, and I think we have been real pioneers in this area. And I think it really started with animal testing and fighting animal testing from the early days of Lush, and it still continues until now because, you know, there's still animals being tested on for cosmetics, and we are still seeing that 25 years on. And I think the other thing that Lush has been pioneering is in inventing products that didn't require any packaging. So we always paid a lot of attention into how we pack our products, into having both very minimalistic recycled packaging as well as no packaging at all. I'd say we're actually pioneers. I think we were one of the first brands to start talking about regeneration in the supply chain and using regenerative agriculture and agroecology in the supply chain as we began to try and develop projects in our supply chain that would provide both ecological outcomes, social outcomes, as well as great quality products that were, you know, beyond organic. So I think, yeah, I concentrate on those three things. And then, of course, you know, we've adopted renewable energy, especially in the UK, already many, many years ago in 2008. We have a very, I'd say, holistic way of viewing sustainability in a way that goes as far down the supply chain as possible and also through our giving practices. So we have funded and supported a lot of environmental restoration, a lot of climate activism, a lot of animal protection, and that has been a core part of Lush as well.
The world seemed to have caught up with Lush, whereas, you know, if you're going back 25 years ago, having sustainability at the heart of what the business did would have been completely alien to what was typical among the market at the time.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, I remember I'm from Brazil originally, and I think in Brazil we were a little bit more aware of environmental issues because, you know, we could see the forest going, we could see, you know, pollution arriving, plastics arriving. And I remember when I moved to the UK, I was already vegan. That was 2004. And I wanted to work for a business that kind of matched my ethics. And there weren't many options. I remember I knew I had heard of Lush because of the non-animal testing, especially, and because it was a brand that you could actually know which products were vegan at the time. Imagine now, right? That 20 years after, it's so common, and you know we're in the middle of Veganuary, and veganism and plant-based, and this is so common. But back then, to have a company where you could even, you know, the staff would know what was vegan, you could see what was vegan, was already such a big deal that I said, oh, I want to work for this company because, you know, at least they're doing something. And then part of how I got the job was to actually point and what Lush was not doing in 2004, having come, you know, already from a place that had 100% recycling, you know, the city where I grew up in. And I knew Brazil back then was already nearly 50% renewable energy, powered by renewable energy. So I had that in me and I thought, we can go step further, right? Even though this is not common practice, there's still so much more than we can do. And that was like 2004. And I think there was a big wave in 2007 until 2009 with COP in Copenhagen in 2009 and, you know, the Kyoto Protocol and all of that that was present at that time. Also, recycling became something that people were talking about. And then he died with the crisis of 2010-11. And then there was a revival thanks to Extinction Rebellion and Greta and, you know, the Paris Agreement. So we saw like a second wave of environmentalism. And I don't think many brands caught up with the first wave, but I think that second wave is when really being sustainable and being environmentally friendly became something that wasn't just a nice to have. It was essential to doing business, you know, in the 21st century.
You know, obviously Lush is known as a sustainability brand, but how do you ensure that staff across the business have that at the heart of their decision making?
I think we have never been afraid of like employing activists. So I think Lush has a big diversity of people who come to work for us. And, you know, we've had many cases where people are actual activists. They're environmental activists, they're animal activists, they're hunt sabs, and they work for Lush, you know, part-time when they're not being activists, or employing me and other activists in the business in senior roles. Because the more you do that, the more you're really embedding that decision in the business. So I think that's like one strategy. The second strategy, I'd say we've always brought the issues closer to our staff. So instead of just doing training where we talk about issues, we actually bring community members, you know, of the peace community in Colombia, where we get our cocoa butter from, that are, you know, land defenders. Like, they come and speak first person to our staff, and our staff get to meet them and they get to visit the stores. We used to do these big events before the pandemic where we would actually bring activists to us, bring suppliers to us. And that, I think it's very different to know of the issue or to hear the firsthand account of the communities that are being affected by palm oil expansion in Indonesia. You know, it's one thing to talk about climate change and another to actually meet the people who are putting their bodies on the line in order, you know, to get changes in legislation. And I think that direct connection to the causes and the fact that we are running campaigns, we're also a political business, right? We're constantly running campaigns. And that's when we find out. So even if you weren't interested in these things, if you've been with Lush for 10 years, you will have learned about so many core issues, core political issues, that you end up becoming an activist yourself because you have the information and you have also the opportunity to do something about it. I think a lot of apathy is because people feel powerless, right? So if through Lush you can actually influence and you can make change, then why wouldn't you? And that, like, it lightens up the fire in people, right? The fact that you have the platform. And the third thing I think which is worth mentioning is, I think in 2007, and then it became fully fledged in 2017, 2018, is that Lush is now part owned by staff. So some of the shares are held in what we call an employee benefit trust. And the role of the employee benefit trust is to safeguard our ethical charter. So we have an ethical charter, and as staff, we are collectively responsible for our ethical charter and ensuring that the business is compliant with our own ethical charter. And yeah, and I think adding that level of responsibility into the hands of staff is also an interesting way to make sure people stay engaged and connected to the issues.
That's amazing. So I guess in a way, the staff are completely invested in the mission of the company because they obviously have a stake in the company, but also they see the impact that the company has been able to make firsthand with those interactions that they have, obviously, with you know, individuals up and down the supply chain and all of that kind of stuff.
And if I may add, as long as a company put sustainability and changes as a core value, you will have that ripple effect, whether people are activists or not. Is the almost the corporate responsibility to decide on your core value and put sustainability as part of that core value, to then include your employee and make all of your decision according to that core value. And the ripple effect will be from, like, through your employees, but also with your suppliers, with the communication that you have. And it's really important as a core value for a company to have sustainability for growth, really.
I guess, I mean, absolutely. I agree 100%. And the thing with, obviously, in terms of staff, attracting staff, hiring, retention, it makes a big difference now, because it is the way that people are so aware of what's going on, and obviously the dangers that we face in terms of impact of climate change. They want to work for, you know, if you're going to get the best people to work for your business, there needs to be a mission that really is the differentiator for a lot of businesses. And I think it's interesting. I mean, obviously, Lush has been doing it for 25 years. From your point of view, Caroline, as obviously with Lakala as a company that works hand in hand with retailers across the world, what more can businesses do to drive positive change?
I think we can do a lot more, everybody, in short. As Lokala being a net tech company, we have a slightly different positioning because we're not directly, we have an indirect contact with the consumer. But we feel like as a net tech company, we're well positioned to actually help brands achieve their goal. And that's really where we see it. And what is really interesting is we published a Retail Insight report back in December, offering a top line or high level view of the sector post-COVID, especially post-COVID, because we wanted to take that into account. And what we realize is having a conscious approach to business growth is what has become essential for brands to stay relevant. So it's not just about saying that we do things, or it's really integrating that conscious approach. And I think brands need to do that a lot more. Everybody needs to start measuring their environmental impact. A lot of companies are at the beginning of their journey, and it's really measuring and starting to put actionable strategy in place to meet the consumer expectation. We also feel that communicating about the brand's commitment is important, but what we need to do more of is take action and bring the different partners in our sector, in our vertical, to implement those changes. It's not just making changes as a company, is making changes as an industry that we need to do more of. And at the moment, that Lush, I mean, you've been leading the way for a long time. We talked about it, but not everybody has caught up. Like we talk about natural ingredient, but we, in terms of packaging, myself, like I try to limit the product that I purchase. I have packaging or unnecessary packaging. And it's still very difficult in 2022, 2023 now to find a package-less product. So there's still a lot to do, and we need to do it as an industry as opposed to a company alone, because I mean, we found out, Bruce, you mentioned it, as activists, we can't do anything alone. So it's really taking that industry with us. And I also feel like developing either secondhand strategy when you're a retailer and communicating about it is really important. And from a digital point of view, reusing your digital assets, trying to limit the overproduction of digital content, because even though it's stored in your laptop and you can't physically touch it, it's still very important to talk to our partner and say, if you already have digital content, reuse them. Don't produce again. Because if we limit our consumption, personal or professional, we will still make an impact. And I think that's where businesses can do a lot more of.
I mean, obviously, when we're talking about sustainability, and especially in terms of retail, ultimately, the consumer is the one who's going to define the way businesses, you know, the steps businesses take. And obviously, the massive growth in vegan and plant-based over the last few years has been consumer-driven through the information that they've obviously been made aware of through activism and through some of the, you know, different initiatives that Ruth was talking about. I suppose, Ruth, obviously, one of the main aspects of Lush is, you know, you've been educating and encouraging consumers to make more sustainable decisions. If you were, I mean, it's a difficult question to answer, I know, because there's obviously many different facets of that. But how do you go about that as a business? What are the lessons that Lush has learned that perhaps other retailers can learn from in terms of showing consumers a path that they should take to sustainability?
I also think that we don't necessarily have gotten this perfectly right all the time. But I really think it's about taking customers on a journey. And I think the emotional connection and the storytelling are so important. And I always say that I think it's important that Lush positions itself as a place where me as a customer, I can come and I can honor my integrity. I can uphold my own personal values and my own desire, you know, as we say at Lush, to leave the world lusher than we found it, like to make sure that I am thinking about future generations and I'm being conscious about how I live. And Lush is there to help you in your journey to also bring more integrity and more ethics and more, sustainability and regeneration into your life. So I think making it easy for customers to make that choice is really important. And I think the fact that Lush has, you know, loud and colorful and beautiful and nice smelling products that perhaps are not just appealing to, your deep green, what we call like deep green customers, but it has a broad commercial appeal and it can appeal to young people, to adults. So I think making more environmentally friendly products widely appealing is the right way of doing this. Making it easy, like as you said, Caroline, like it's not so easy to find products without packaging. Like we actually made shampoo, conditioner, deodorant, right? Moisturizer. So you have a choice. For me, that's how we can do this journey. In the UK now, we're seeing some really interesting collaboration coming up between supermarkets and brands and logistics companies and packaging washing facilities. And there will be a sweet spot of convenience for the customers where we're not expecting customers to bring 30 glass bottles or metal bottles to be refilled in the supermarket. Nor, you know, just suddenly being delivered with all singing on dancing refillable packaging. So we need to find the sweet spot. And I think Lush, with our naked products, we found that sweet spot. So we're not asking you to make a huge change. It's just perhaps changing your shampoo bottle for a solid shampoo bar that is also going to deliver great value. So I think layering those benefits for the customer is really important. And we have seen growth, and it's interesting as well, because I was digging out, I've been working for Lush for a very long time and in this role for a very long time. And I was digging out a presentation that I did in 2008 that I actually had some statistics of what percentage of our sales were naked products, like products without packaging. And it was about 45%. And we're at 60, but we've been at 60 for the last 10 years. So it seems that 60% has been the ceiling for us. And I've also, and that's why we're also thinking, perhaps we need to now go into refilling, because it may be that we have maxed, you know, the amount of naked products that we can sell. But that's just Lush. You know, if you think all the if you think that 60% of cosmetics in the market, and we talked about, you know, whole market changes, could go into solid, unpackaged cosmetics, that would make such a huge change. But I don't think it's ever going to go to 100%. So we need to come up with, you know, what's next. Yeah.
I mean, that was actually going to be one of my other questions, was what the consumer appetite was for packaging-free goods. And obviously, it's like you said, it's there's always going to be somebody who's going to prefer the convenience of buying something prepackaged, ready to use, and then they throw away that packaging. But it's really interesting to me that the number that you're seeing is, you know, 60% is a really significant number. I mean, even the 15% growth from 45% going back to 2008, I think is still really significant. And I suppose this, you know, as more information becomes available and people address their own activities and habits in terms of their impact on the environment, do you think that they potentially that consumer appetite for packaging free will still grow further?
Yeah, I think it's also to do with the performance of the cosmetics, right? They perform slightly different. So I think we need formulation to improve as well of solid cosmetics, not just Lush. I'm talking about, you know, the industry in general. Like shampoo bars is an interesting one. It's so much more convenient and so much cheaper per wash, and it lasts so much longer, and the environmental impacts are so much greater that we should really scale this globally. And only now the big brands like Garnier launched a shampoo bar. Only now the big brands are catching up with us. So it may be that as we get scale from, you know, some of those bigger brands, that it will also increase market share of shampoo bars. We tried to get some data on the market share of shampoo bars. And there isn't a lot of data out there, but we think that I was trying to calculate what's the indirect impact of us having invented shampoo bars. And it's about 1,000 tons of plastic per year, which is great, but it's a very small fraction of all the plastic that's generated, you know, per year for cosmetics.
I think there's also an element in that specific section where brands need to start using advertising and media almost to educate the population and just pass that on, that message that habits need to change. We will lose that convenience, and it's the same in a way to when you travel. If you want to travel more sustainably, you need to change your habit. And what we have found, especially around the Christmas period, is some of the retailers we work with use media to not just drive people to physical location through, you know, engaging creative, but going through the messaging and talking about sustainability. We supported quite a lot of retailers in driving people to pop-up store to learn about how to upcycle your clothes and how to manage your habits slightly differently. And there's a big drive on fashion, because that's one of the key talking points at the moment. But it's really important to use what we have, the tool that we have available, in a slightly different way to educate everybody on that topic and not just to advertise per se. That's always important.
And I suppose with those companies that you're working with that have chosen that path, is that something that you see with a lot of the companies that Lokala works with, or is that just, you know, certain companies that are obviously trying to appeal to certain markets are leaning into that sort of messaging? Or is this just, do you see this as something that's, there is change afoot in the retail industry as a whole?
It really depends on the company objective, really. It goes back to putting the core, depending on your core value. But as far as we're concerned, we have seen, especially with local retailer or shopping center, that need to maybe shop a bit more local, to use more local store data and foot traffic visitation trends to fuel their targeting strategy and better understand where local audience are. Even if you have a national approach, is really understanding where your local audience is and how can you better leverage your targeting strategies and your media investment to target more efficiently. And it goes back to consuming better and utilizing all of the data that we have in the world to be more efficient and limiting the waste. And that's what we have found, that appetite for data, for where is my audience? Is my audience passing by? Are users like switching from one brand to another? And how can we better communicate to pass a message, to communicate about the goal of that brand? And it's really that shift that we're seeing, which is really, really interesting.
That is interesting. And I suppose with Lush, the focus has been on natural ingredients, self-preserving products. It's very much the core of your strategy. But you know, obviously you're working with suppliers to, you know, procure those ingredients and create those products. What are some of the ways that you've, you know, ensured that you're sourcing materials that are planet friendly?
Yeah, I know, you know, we talked about data again, and I think having that full understanding of the value chain and where the biggest impacts are is so important. And for any, I think, cosmetics companies, the bulk of the impact is in the supply chain. So, you know, it's still really difficult to ensure there is absolutely no deforestation in the supply chain connected to natural raw materials. We also know that there are many, many natural raw materials with a significant bigger footprint than synthetic, their synthetic counterparts. So there is also a little fallacy of, you know, giving a lot of importance to only natural raw materials because of the impact that they can have. And it's hard because most cosmetics companies are also, especially if you're smaller, you're buying products from distributors with very little visibility into what happens past tier one of your supply chain. And I think one of the things that we have been working diligently, I think since 2007, is really to, as Lush got bigger, to rely less and less on distributors and developing direct relationships with suppliers. So I'd say, I think the first thing we do is to visit suppliers, have long-standing relationships that, you know, span decades sometimes with our suppliers, and having that, building that direct trust, I'd say is one of the most important parts. And then more recently, I'd say in the last, you know, we have a sourcing team and a buying team that, you know, are very knowledgeable. Most people are trained in permaculture and regenerative agriculture. Like, they actually have the training to also support suppliers. We have an in-house agroecologist that, you know, his work is to work with suppliers, train farmers on agroecology production methods. We also set up a lot of our own projects. So we started this in 2010, more or less. It's finding what are the groups that are already working with farmers on agroecology that we can partner with and develop a bigger project that helps them scale that work. And now we created sourcing hubs that, this is actually a really nice story. So when you look at where cosmetics ingredients come from, they're all coming from high biodiversity habitats, right? So palm oil is coming from Indonesia and Sumatra, and so many products are like soy is coming on the buffer zone of the Amazon, or, you know, the Cerrado, the savanna in Brazil. There are so many raw materials that are coming from very important habitats that are worth protecting and at the moment are having a detrimental impact. So we thought, well, what if we can do the opposite? If we can scope raw materials and ingredients from those areas, from high biodiversity areas or large carbon sinks, but that are actually bringing benefit to communities and benefit to biodiversity and benefit to the ecosystem, and start sourcing from them. So we developed what we call sourcing hubs, and we have a sourcing hub in Latin America, in the Mediterranean, in Africa, and in Far East, and in the Middle East, Mediterranean. And really finding amazing projects, working in partnerships with conservation organizations that are, you know, protecting the orangutans in Sumatra, or the Komodo dragon in Timor, or that are protecting, you know, the Gola rainforest in Sierra Leone, or they're protecting the Amazon. And use our products and use the cosmetics industry to really regenerate and protect. Like, this is a core function that we can have as a cosmetics industry, especially with non-food items. So that's something that we have been diligent about. But then we also need to make sure everything else, and not just, you know, those niche materials, are also compliant. And this is where the buying team comes in, and we have a supply chain impact team. And the supply chain impact team, both they do like the auditing, the suppliers surveys, but they're also doing the metrics and the data. And yeah, we've been discovering so much juicy information and juicy data, and really getting to the point where we know now what are the top 10 materials that if we just work on those top 10 materials, our environmental impact of the supply chain can greatly reduce. And to get that level of precision is really important right now because we don't have infinite time. So we need to be using the money and the time and you know our efforts in the things that are going to deliver most benefit. And for us, that's both working on you know our most impactful ingredients and the most beneficial ingredients and working on those two ends, the footprint and the handprint. The carbon reductions and the carbon removals, you know, that's the thinking that we're having at the moment.
Lush has been completely unafraid to take a stand on issues, even if it means that the brand's going to take heat from certain areas of the press, over political and social campaigns. Why do you think that it's important for Lush to do that?
Because everything is political. And, you know, like our food choices are political. The choices of material we use are political. How we choose our energy is political. Everything is political. So we are, you know, we are an active part of a democracy. And I think for companies to not take a stand at the moment, we are missing an opportunity of using some of the bigger voices that we have in our society at the moment, which in a capitalist society, in neoliberal capitalism, those that have power are businesses. I completely disagree with that as an anarchist, but it is the way things are. So businesses and companies exert a disproportionate amount of power in our society. And then for companies to not take a stance that is pro-diversity, that is pro, you know, more progressive thinking, that is really supporting the grassroots, I think it's a missed opportunity. So I think we've always been aware of the platform that we have. And I think from that awareness is, well, how can we use this platform to actually create change beyond just our industry? And instead of us having a voice, we're like, how can we gift our platform? So our campaigning is a little bit like our charitable giving. We don't decide how our partners are going to spend the money. It's the same thing with our campaigns. It's not Lush doing a campaign. It's Lush giving a platform. And that platform is our website, our windows, our staff, our shops, to a group that has something to say that is currently not being heard. So, you know, whether it's animal rights, whether it's, you know, climate change and fossil fuel, whether it's LGBTQIA+ rights, you know, it's how can we use Lush really as a platform for some of those unheard voices in our society? And we always say that a campaign is not successful unless someone is saying boycott Lush, you know, that then we know we're being radical enough. We're not playing safe.
There must have been so many boycotts over the years. I was thinking when I was researching this podcast, I was thinking, I don't know if there's a brand that's been hashtag boycotted as much as Lush has, but I suppose that means that you're doing it right, because it's the weird thing about the way, especially with the way that social media works now, is the signal boosting often comes from people who are going, this is a disgrace, this is an outrage, and actually that helps to promote the cause and shows solidarity with things that you care about.
Yeah. And I think we're genuine as well. I think the other thing is,
yeah,
we are very careful to make sure that we're not using the campaigns for marketing, and that the political campaigns that we, you know, land our stores for are not, they are really not a marketing ploy, because often we get boycott campaigns about Lush, or, you know, we actually don't see sales increase when we have campaigns in our windows. If we have a super commercial campaign, you know, sales go up. So we've been careful to uphold our reputation with the campaigning groups and with the activists and with the grassroots groups. Although, of course, you know, we're not perfect, and there have been issues as well in the past. But I think that's also important. I think we're seeing a blend of, because of purpose, you know, purpose-led capitalism, I think we're seeing more and more those two things combining. And at Lush, I think we have been a little bit more careful to make sure that this is not a marketing ploy. And that's why we've managed to do it for such a long time, yeah, without losing credibility.
And Caroline, from Lacala's point of view and from where you sit, obviously working with loads and loads of different companies as part of your business, because that's what you do, you know, do you think that businesses should be taking stands on these issues, and should more businesses actually nail their colors to the wall and say, look, this is where we sit, this is what we support, this is when you're doing business with us, this is what you're getting, you know, from, this is who you're buying from?
I think, yes. I mean, Ruth, you summarized it pretty well. I don't think all companies have that power to be able, or that not all companies are big enough to just have those activists, campaigns in general. But I think every single company should make a stand. And I always go back to the core value. You have to have sustainability. You have to keep that in mind. Because, and I will even go a step further, is consumers want to know more. And they want transparency. They want to know what they're buying and who they're buying from. So if you don't have that as your core value, and if you don't make steps to, whether you claim it or whether you do your day-to-day, putting that value in everything that you do, you really have, like, consumers, whether you're B2B or B2C, want that transparency, and they will ask you the question, and you have to be able to prove that what you believe in is what you put in your business on a day-to-day basis, because ultimately that's what consumers want and what the planet needs also. So yeah, I think we have the power to make a change, and companies should take a stand.
Obviously as well, we'd be doing a disservice to a sustainability podcast if we didn't talk about greenwashing. And obviously with the fact that we're all talking about how, you know, being sustainable, being ethical, you know, looking, making sure that you are on top of your supply chains and where your products and the goods you're creating or you're selling are coming from, has become a differentiator for consumers. It's obviously going to grow. There's going to be more companies that try to do things, you know, take shortcuts and, you know, claim their environmental credentials when they don't have them. So to both of you, obviously with this, with greenwashing on the increase, what do you think can be done to, I mean, I'm sure there's no way you can stamp out companies claiming to be environmental or sustainable completely. But what do you think can be done? Is it a case of, you know, there needs to be more regulatory intervention? Should there be penalties for companies that do it? Or is it just a case of consumers will see through it, and it has a way of kind of working itself out when companies are, you know, taking an inauthentic approach to environmentalism and sustainability? Starting with you, Caroline, what do you think on this one?
I think it's a difficult one. Companies have, in a way, Ruth, you mentioned it, we have limited time. So as companies, we should all be smart and understand that we don't have time to play and pretend in our actions. We should really use our platform to make a difference. But more than that, I think we have switched from like 10 years ago, 20 years ago, to a consumer-centric world, where before it was really the brand were communicating, making the product, and consumer didn't really have a way to feedback. And I think we switch, and through social media, through direct communication, consumers have their own, like they can share their view. And I feel like brands now have to catch up. It's almost like we reverse, and greenwashing is still there, but consumers are educated on the matter. They do their research. They have more tools available to understand, well, when you say you're planting trees, are you planting trees anywhere? Or have you partners with companies that are investing in sustainable forestry? Or how do you make all of that decision? And I think consumers have the platform, have the knowledge, they understand the importance of that matter, and they won't buy. They will see through it by researching, and they won't buy ultimately through companies that are not truthful. And for me, that's ultimately the biggest penalty, because we're not just in a world where you can say, oh, I'm sustainable and not do anything. And that would be, that's the world we live in. And I think it's great for consumers to have the final say and be able to say, actually, especially going back to animal testing, it's really important. Like a lot of big corporations are now like influenced by the consumer, because the consumer don't want to purchase product that have been tested on animals. People don't want to purchase product that will impact the planet, and they're not afraid to say it. And I don't think greenwashing will, it's there, unfortunately. I think it will still happen, but consumer will only be more aware of that matter and more educated. And yeah.
And Ruth, what's your take on it? Is do you feel the same? Do you think that it's a case of it's super hard to hide now, which I do personally think, you know, most of the companies that seem to be engaged in the more blatant greenwashing seem to be outed quite quickly. But should there be more regulation? Should there be, you know, penalties? Should there be something else that comes in from a governmental or level?
Yeah, we have the Green Claims Code that I think came into force just over a year ago. And then, you know, there are people already being prosecuted as part of the Green Claims Code, which is connected to the I think it's like the Competition and Markets Authority or the Advertising
Authority.
Right,
okay.
And they have, you know, and it's really interesting, because some of the things there are really strong. Like, for example, you cannot make a claim about one part of the product without have considered the full life cycle of the product. So I cannot say, oh yeah, this packaging is green because it has recycled packaging, or because it has, but if the rest of the product doesn't have any claim. So I cannot just attribute, say, oh yeah, this is a green product, but the only thing that's green about it is the 100% recycled paper tag, you know? So they are, yeah, and anyone can, including the consumer, can, can like send information and ask for that company or that claim to be investigated. So I think that's really interesting. Yeah, and then the second thing, I think I agree with everything that Caroline said, but the other thing is there is also already some interesting industry collaboration, like the Eco Beauty Score, which we're not part of, but a bunch of companies and the big cosmetics companies are coming together to align on a standardized way of assessing cosmetics, so that the consumer can have like a kind of a nutritional label. So it's A, B, C, D, like a nutritional label. So I think we're moving towards that combination of data-driven, you know, information, lots of storytelling and transparency, and being able to visit the website, watching a video, QR code, like connecting the consumer to what's happening, or the citizen, as we like to call, to what's happening, what stands behind that product, and legislation. I agree with you. I don't think we can just think that the market is going to self-regulate when it comes to greenwashing.
That's kind of interesting that's happening with cosmetics, because it does seem the one thing that is still tricky for myself as a consumer Obviously, you've got brands like Lush who communicate what's going on with the products that they're selling. But elsewhere, if you're just going to, you know, do your shop or, you know, shopping online especially, is having something like a Nutri-Score or like a traffic light system for products would be a really good way to actually quickly be able to see for a consumer, oh, well, this is actually, this got a score of an A. I'm happy to purchase this. Or maybe if you're like, oh, it got a B, that's okay. I might buy that occasionally. So that sounds like a really good idea to me.
The amount of work, though, and the amount of data, and then everyone is relying on databases and not necessarily primary information as well and primary data. So I think it's like, it's a work in progress, but I also see, because it can also be very overwhelming to give the customer lots of information. And, you know, as we mentioned before, it's like it's the TikTok generation. You have 15 seconds, right, to communicate things to customers. So how do you do it through, better to maybe simplified ways of communicating complex information? And what I was going to say about greenwashing as well, which I also think has been mentioned here as well by Caroline, it's the fact that ultimately, greenwashing is anti-business, because there is no business on a dead planet. There is no business, like there is no viable economy when the planet is at 3 degrees of warming and we have, you know, destroyed the oceans and the forests and our capacity to survive. So I think ultimately, like this is not just about consumers and this is not just about following legislation. This is also about the longevity of the economy and the longevity of our civilization and, you know, being able to do business in 20, 30, 40, 50 years time. So I think we need to start thinking of this as really with the weight that it should have, rather than just it's because my brand needs to look good. This is because my brand needs to survive.
Well, I think that's a great way to wrap up the episode. I mean, we could talk about this stuff for hours. So I really appreciate you both joining me today to discuss sustainability. And it's going to be really interesting to follow, obviously, the steps that Lush takes, but also the you know, retail industry as a whole, I think, is going to make big leaps in the next few years. Because, as you said, Ruth, we have to. There isn't an option. There's no planet B for us. So thank you both for joining me today. I'm your host, Matt Ridout, and you've been listening to Ruth Andrade, Earth Care Strategy Lead for Lush, and Caroline Shajas, UK Business Director for Lakala. And this is the Retail Inside Out podcast from Retail Gazette. Listen on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Thank you for listening.